Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 8th. The vice president has called Hawaii's Medicaid fraud unit a disgrace. State leaders are pushing back how they plan to get back on track and unfreeze millions in federal funding. We gear up for the midterm elections and take a look at a few key rematches in races with razor-thin margins. And funding for a long-term health study tied to the Maui wildfires has ended. What happens next? Plus, a high-profile case about how an attack on Hawaiian monk seal turns our attention to why few cases are actually prosecuted. And we hear from the record holder of the youngest to swim across the Ka'iwi Channel, his record held for more than three decades. It's a swimming of age story. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit received roughly $3 million from the federal government last year. It was to root out kickbacks, phantom billing, and other forms of health care fraud. Now that funding is up in the air as the Department of Health and Human Services denied the unit's recertification just last week. Federal leaders have put Hawaii's program in the crosshairs as an example of mismanagement. Take a listen to Vice President J.D. Vance at a news conference last month.
The Hawaii Medicaid program has received billions and billions of dollars from the federal taxpayers. And of course, Hawaii taxpayers have paid in a lot of money into this program over the last years as well. Guess how many convictions or indictments has Hawaii had over the last few years in its Medicaid fraud program? The answer is zero. Not a single indictment, not a single conviction, because the administrators of the Hawaii program just don't take it seriously. They don't think that fraud is a big enough problem. They don't care about protecting resources. They don't care about protecting that Medicaid program. So what does that mean? That means that if you're committing fraud in Medicaid in Hawaii, at least up until now, hopefully now they're going to take it seriously, you have had effectively free rein from the government of Hawaii to commit as much fraud as you want. That is a complete disgrace.
And Governor Josh Green convened a strike force just last week to tackle Medicaid abuse with the hopes of convincing the federal government to change its mind. The strike force is run under the State Department of Human Services. Former Trump White House lawyer Mike Papura was also tapped to support the group. DHS Director Joseph Campos spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the new strike force housed in his department. He defended the work of Medicaid fraud investigators.
Hawaii has had civil convictions, right? We've had civil cases in which I believe we've recouped $14 million. So I think that that's important to recognize. You know, so it's not just criminal prosecution that reflects how appropriate or how effective your fraud unit detection or fraud unit control is performing. In addition, you know, the eligibility workers on the front line at Medicaid really are doing phenomenal work to ensure that we are complying with all of the standards necessary so that the incidence of fraud is mitigated from the very beginning.
If I could just pressure test that point that you made about recoveries, looking at the letter that the federal government sent to Hawaii's department denying the recertification of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. They look at between 2021 and 2025 in recoveries and found that the return on investment, so the money that the unit was able to get back compared to its expenditures, it was only 2023 that the unit made more money than it spent. Is that an issue in your mind?
You know, I look at it differently. I look at the fact that if you're going to fund a Medicaid fraud control unit, you're funding them to do the job to ensure that fraud is detected. And if it's not detected, they're still doing the work. So to say that you need to have a specific threshold of convictions when there may not be that level doesn't, you know, really equate, right? You're funding a unit to ensure that fraud is detected. But if there is no fraud, then you're still funding the unit to do the work. So I think having a requirement that says, well, you have to have so much additional funds or, you know, funds over the amount that we paid, you have to collect. Well, if there is no fraud or if there's no criminal fraud, right? Because criminal fraud has a very different standard, a different bar that is set, right? In order to prove that. So the fact that, according to the Attorney General's office, since 2021, more than 14 million in judgment settlements and recoveries were received shows that the unit was doing the work necessary that they were receiving funding for, right? So I think that it's a very sort of problematic perception or perspective to say, well, we paid you X amount, so thus you need Y amount in recovery.
I think something that caught people's eyes also was the mention of Mike Purpura, who's going to be on this strike force, who is a legal professional who spent time working for the Trump White House in the first Trump administration, including defending the president from impeachment. And I'm wondering if you could speak to why he's the best person for this job.
Sure. Well, you know, Mr. Purpura, you know, has a longstanding familiarity with the state of Hawaii. Yes, he was a former federal prosecutor, a former White House deputy counsel, and he has expertise in complex litigation, complex investigation, fraud enforcement, and coordination with federal law enforcement agencies and other federal partners. The firm that he's with, Houston Hennigan, is a nationally recognized firm for its work on high-profile investigations, complex litigation, and government enforcement matters. So I think what's important to really put forward is the concept that fraud is not a partisan issue, right? All of us, no matter what, where we lie on the political spectrum, we all want to ensure that public funds, taxpayer dollars, are expended appropriately. And so because it's not a partisan issue, I think Governor Green's foresight and ability to recognize that, hey, one of the best people, one of the expertise in this area is familiar with Hawaii, right? Understands our culture, understands the way we navigate the world. And so I think Governor Green is spot on to ensure that we have someone who has the experience of working with the federal government at the highest levels and also understands Hawaii.
Okay. If I could be a little more blunt here, you do not see this as a way of potentially currying favor with the Trump administration by hiring a lawyer who has worked closely with it before?
Absolutely not. And again, you know, I think Governor Green wants to show that we are as serious as the federal government is in preventing fraud and detecting fraud. And if so happens that one of the experts in the area used to work for the federal government, used to work for President Trump during the first Trump administration, so be it. You know, it is not a partisan issue. It is an issue to ensure that we protect the fiduciary responsibilities that the state of Hawaii has, and that we move forward in a way that is most efficient for the state.
In terms of timeline, the strike force has a report due to the governor by the end of this year. And then in parallel, there's also potentially the recertification process that the fraud unit within the Attorney General's office would have to fulfill. What key deadlines are you looking at on the calendar right now?
Well, so the deadlines looking at the calendar is one, I thank the governor for giving us 6 months. You know, that was nice that he provided us some room to figure all this out. Immediately, we will be setting up the task force. It'll include executives of DHS, you know, with specific knowledge of Medicaid, It will include members from the Attorney General's office. You know, so we'll immediately set that up. We'll immediately start the process, figure out, do an assessment of what's needed, you know, really do a deep dive into the letter that came out, you know, making sure that we understand the parameters that we need to address. And then, of course, maybe within 2 or 3 months, already have a draft of the report ready so that we can ensure that we are performing appropriately and addressing all the necessary matters that have been brought up.
And so in, let's say, 6 months' time when this final report is due, what does success for the strike force look like to you?
Right. So the top goal is to recertify Hawaii's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, first and foremost, right? After that, it's to ensure that all the processes that we have in place are appropriate. I believe they currently are. You know, the fact, again, that since 2021, the state, through the Medicaid Fraud Unit, has recovered $14 million, you know, in settlements and agreements, I think already shows that they know what they're doing. And we just want to make sure that we, what is the saying? You put a ribbon around it, or you put a bow on it, right? So that there are no questions, and that we can show that, yes, we have and will continue to do the appropriate means in order for us to detect and possibly prosecute fraud cases.
And just once more, going back to some of the pushback that the unit has gotten, both, I mean, along these more formal channels in terms of denying the recertification, but also Vice President J.D. Vance has made comments on the record essentially disparaging Hawaii's Medicaid fraud enforcement. And so you feel like those criticisms are maybe unfounded at this point?
I think people say things for specific reasons. You know, I'm not going to speculate on what the reasons were. Clearly, it's all part of this same narrative that the federal government is projecting. We know what we do. We are in constant communication with CMS, and we have been assured that our Medicaid program is in good standing, right? That the cuts were to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And again, governor's main priority is to ensure that the people of Hawaii get the health insurance that they need and are entitled to through Medicaid.
That's important, that this is not going to affect individuals' eligibility or what they receive if they receive Medicaid.
Correct.
On that note, anything else that you would want listeners to know right now?
Yeah, so really, we just want to drive home the point that the Department of Human Services wants to reassure the Medicaid participants, Medicaid providers, and the community at large that we are strong, we are confident in the work we do, and we are in good standing with CMS, and that this strike force is designed to ensure that there are no adverse effects to the Medicaid program itself.
That was Department of Human Services Director Joe Campos and HPR's Maddie Bender. They were discussing the governor's new Medicaid fraud strike force that was formed to root out waste, fraud, and abuse in our healthcare system. Tis the season. Campaign signs are popping up across the state as candidates running for public office have officially declared they are racing to get your vote. This morning, we have star advertiser, political reporter Dan Nicasso joining us to talk about this political season. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, you have an article today that talked about, turnout. It's probably
right.
Not going to be very high because there are just not a lot of races that might interest voters.
That's right. Our two U.S. senators are not up for re-election this year. The governor is not in a what many are calling a non-competitive race for the primary, let alone against a Republican in the general. The most competitive races are the U.S. House seats, both to represent urban Honolulu and Jill Takuda's seat to represent rural Oahu and all the neighbor islands. And the other race that's getting interest is lieutenant governor's race, which has suddenly become much more competitive when Della Albalotti switched from the congressional two House race to the lieutenant governor's race, giving a named competitor against Eric Kawakami, the mayor of Kauai.
Yes, and that would be an interesting race to watch. And then also, we're seeing some familiar names. I know in my district, we've got Tommy Waters running against Trevor Ozawa, the former councilman.
Yeah. No, there's some hurt feelings left over from the last challenge by Trevor Ozawa of Tommy Waters. Now, they're not running for the council chair, but they are running for Tommy Waters' seat, which would could affect the future chair of the Honolulu County Council. That last election, they went head-to-head, went down to a challenge, and it got a little nasty. So that'll be interesting to watch as well.
Yes, and you had mentioned the state races, and there was another race that was also very close with the former teachers union leader who was making a bid, and that was a very close race with Pyrrhic.
Yes. So those two candidates, so Elijah, State Rep Elijah Pyrrhic, is won two elections against Corey Rosenlee, the former head of the HSTA. And those two candidates could not be more different. Rosenlee is a public school teacher, progressive, teaches civics at Campbell High School. Pyrrhic is more evangelical Christian. And at stake is more than just which of the two represents that House seat. Pyrrhic resigned his House seat to take on Senator Lamassao in the Senate district. But at stake is a bigger issue of whether the Republicans will continue to see gain ground on the west side of Oahu, or whether Rosenlee and others might be able to cause a temporary stall in the Republicans' advancement in that area, that whole leeward coast.
Yes, and you know, I know that we have the race also for Congress. You know, Ed Case is seeing some challengers.
Right. Yep.
And as you mentioned, you know, Della Albalotti opted not to go against him and opted for the lieutenant governor's race.
Right. And that looked the Ed Casey race with Balotti and Senator Jarrett Kaohokulole running against Case in the Democratic Party was seen as Case's gotten some criticism from progressive Democrats in urban Honolulu who object to some of the ways he has voted that they consider in support of Trump policies. Ed Case responds that he's cast a lot of votes, and what really matters is entirety of his voting record. But nevertheless, Balotti and Kaohokulole were seen as possibly likely splitting the anti-Case progressive Democratic vote, which would give Case the victory in the primary with just a plurality. And so Balotti saw the picture and wanted to make the lieutenant governor's race competitive, but also it would sort of eliminate that scenario of she and Kaohokulole dividing the liberal vote. And now entering the LG's race, those two candidates, Kawakami, even though they're both Democrats, they have very different profiles. Kawakami supported by the Carpenters, who are very influential in Hawaii politics. Balotti's getting a little late start on mounting a statewide campaign. She's trying to make a grassroots appeal to small donors and possibly considering accepting public financing for her candidacy to get the campaign off the ground.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, those will be some races to watch for sure. But thank you so much,
right.
Dan.
You're welcome. Anytime.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser's political reporter, Dan Nicasso. You look for his stories at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Australian indie rock artist Courtney Barnett performs this Friday and Saturday with songs from her new album, Creature of Habit. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
The world takes you outside your borders.
Johannesburg,
Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan,
Kyiv, Chiba, Japan.
Because what happens there?
When it comes to EVs, Chinese cars eat everyone's lunch.
Affects what happens at home.
The fact that the sides are talking again, that's a positive step.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Listen each weekday to The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. The retrospective Toshiko Takaezu, Worlds Within, covers 70 years of her sculptures, paintings, and weavings. On now, honolulumuseum.org.
Researchers behind an ongoing health study tied to the Maui wildfires are scrambling after state lawmakers opted not to fund the long-term work. Here to talk more about this is HPR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so they were really counting on this state funding to come through.
They were. So the Maui wildfire exposure study has been led by some UH researchers. The state bill that had been set to fund the study at the last minute failed in legislature. You know, it had received support throughout the season, and it really kind of blindsided folks that it did not receive support right at the very end. I think it was like the last day or two of the session. The study did get over $2 million from the state back in 2024. They've also been supported by the National Institutes of Health and a bunch of philanthropic grants. But at this point, they say there's no funding to continue, and they actually had their last participant from the study last week. The study co-leads are Ruben Juarez and Alika Mauna Kea of University of Hawaii. They were in Washington, D.C. last week talking to politicians, trying to, you know, get support, receive, you know, get financial support. And Ruben told me that it was a very productive trip, that Hawaii's congressional delegation is helping to raise awareness of, you know, the ongoing need for funding for the study. But, you know, of course, these things take a while. We probably won't know for a while if they will be successful in getting any funding on the federal side. But the study has served more than 2,500 people since it began right at the end of 2023, you know, just months after the Maui wildfires. Over 4,000 appointments for health screenings, mental health assessments, physical health checks, referrals, you know, they really did a lot. And, you know, they did a lot more than just gather data. You know, they were really there for folks giving on the ground healthcare as well, many of whom folks, you know, weren't able to receive healthcare otherwise. And the exposure study was really important to track and understand, you know, these long-term health impacts of the wildfires that we probably won't see for a while. But, you know, as I said, a lot of Lahaina residents really depended on it for access to basic healthcare, Ruben Juarez explains.
It's not a study, it's really a community program. And then we do research along with it, right? You know, the science allows to measure what is happening and understand the long-term impacts of the fire. And this is actually providing learnings, not only for Hawaii and to be a resiliency in the state for the next disaster, but it's really providing learning for the next disaster, what LA can do and some of the other fires that are happening, you know, right now. The second thing that the program is doing is it also gives results, connects people to care, identifies risk early, and it's helping decision makers understand where the needs are the greatest and where they need to put their money. And unfortunately, you know, for many participants, this is just not abstract research. It is one of the few places where they can get results. This is a rural area, underserved community. You know, the people who come to us are, you know, basically participants who don't have access to care. Okay, that's a reality. This is uninsured populations, Kupuna, you know, who cannot travel all the way from Lahaina to Wailuku. Some of the findings that we are seeing, right, is that there is definitely the immediate physical health issues, okay? But really what the corollary of this is that these physical health issues will also have mental health issues, and then they are going to manifest not only for 1-2 years post-wildfire, but we are expecting this is going to take 5, potentially 10 years. And we are really trying to evaluate this and provide the learnings so the state can act in a more coordinated way.
Interesting. But yeah, I can see how they were probably set back if they were banking on that state money.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Juarez talked about 9/11 researchers and how they found after a disaster like that, you know, a lot of the impacts weren't seen for years after, a lot of the environmental impacts on people's health. And so, you know, being able to track those long term, I think, is a big part of what their goal in this exposure study was. You know, another big part of it was mental health. Dr. Chris Knightsbridge is a study co-author as well as working as a clinical psychologist in Lahaina. You know, he talked to me about how, you know, even almost 3 years later now, people are still in survival mode. You know, basic needs still aren't being met. They're worried about housing. They're worried about putting food on the table. They're worried about where they're going to get money just for basic living. And one of the biggest gaps in understanding of all of this impacts of the wildfire is also children. The study only included about 200 keiki, and about half of the funding from that failed bill had been allocated toward expanding the program into schools and in bringing in, you know, close to 1,000 kids, I think was their goal. And so Knightsbridge, you know, is really worried about the mental health of keiki. And, you know, he says fire survivor, you know, patients as young as 6 are, you know, having suicidal thoughts, and it's really concerning for him. And so he was really heartbroken about the funding loss and its implications for fire survivors.
The community is amazing, which is why I get a bit kind of passionate, a bit angry when I feel that our state is neglecting their needs, or they try to minimize the data that is collected, or try to say that things are okay, because they're not. They're not okay. Basic needs have not even been met yet. You're only asking for $3 million. It was $1.5 to sustain current cohort, and another $1.5 was going to be to go out to schools and increase our child cohort by like at least 800. And then from there, like, we would be able to get their family members involved and make sure everybody's okay. It's like a no-brainer investment in Lahaina. And we don't just test Lahaina, so it's Maui's future. We've been told this is pretty much a gold standard model of post-disaster research by a ton of different research groups. So we're going to have to beg and hope that the county could help us, or somebody with the means can help save us, you know, and help prevent an entire generation of children from suffering this kind of generational trauma. We're willing to put in the work. We just need the support.
Yeah, so with this future of this study so uncertain, I mean, gosh, if they just saw their last clients last week, there could be a real lag.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, they're going out, like, as Knightsbridge mentioned, you know, I think they're talking to the county. They're trying to, you know, again, reach out to those philanthropic sources to try and drum up funding, just to at least continue the bare minimum, you know, the folks that they already had in the study, be able to continue supporting them into the long term and following along in their journeys. But right now, you know, the future of the study is really uncertain. So we'll just have to wait and see what funding comes through, if they're able to pick that back up.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking with HR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can find the story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 88 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
On the next Fresh Air, in celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Tony Award-winning musical The Book of Mormon, the two original stars, Andrew Rannells and Josh Gad, will make guest appearances in a Broadway revival. We'll talk to both of them about the show and how it changed their lives. They're both really funny, on and off stage. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
A man charged with harassing an endangered monk seal is set to appear in federal court tomorrow. HPR's Cassie Ordonio joins us this morning to talk about how this case is turning attention to why so few cases actually get prosecuted. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And so this gentleman, he's a visitor, right? He's from Washington State?
Yeah. And he is named Igor Litvinchuk. He is scheduled to reappear in federal court tomorrow at 10 a.m. here in Hawaii. And this is just kind of like a follow-up on the case already, where, you know, the judge and the attorneys are just going to do like a follow-up procedural thing of where they're at in the case, whether they want to settle or move forward and set dates for a pretrial. You know, but this case comes as that one social media post sparked widespread outrage, actually, among the public and government officials as well. We saw in that video where Igor allegedly took this coconut-sized rock and hurled it towards a monk seal's head, nearly missing it. And that has even prompted the Maui mayor, Richard Bisson, to kind of vow more accountability and to have him prosecuted to the full extent.
Yeah, but in this case, there was evidence, right? You hid the video.
Exactly. And so he could be facing fines up to $70,000 under the Marine Mammal Act and the Endangered Species Act. And then he could also face up fines to $100,000 under the Criminal Fine Improvement Acts. But, you know, when I spoke to William Isla, the former chair of the State Department of Land and Natural Resources, he said this case is different from others because the fact that Igor Litvinchuk was caught on camera. And he says while there's some education on Hawaii's wildlife in the state, there still needs to be more.
Well, there's more education that certainly can be done. As far as this individual, I think all the education in the world would not replace his sort of arrogant, I can do what I want attitude because I have money. I think for most normal people, education about monk seals is enough for them to be respectful. But I think there are other people who, again, they're privileged. And so they show a lack of respect because they think they're entitled.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had that one case, too, where that one visitor went up and slapped the monk seal that was laying on the beach, right?
Yes, that was a woman. And then I believe around 2020, 2021, during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was also another viral video of a man going up, filming himself slapping a monk seal. So these cases continue to happen of harassing. And there's also been cases of killings of monk seals. Mm-hmm. Molokai is particularly famous for that, or yeah. Infamous for that.
Yeah, no, you've got, I think it was a monk seal that was shot, you know, but yet very few of those cases have been prosecuted.
And that goes back to William Isla's point, is that during his tenure at DLNR, there weren't that many cases because there were no smartphones back in the day. There weren't enough people with phones who can record those cases and report it right away or share it on social media. When you look at the laws, though, because Igor Litvinchuk is being charged under federal laws, he's not being charged for Hawaii state law. So back in 2011, Hawaii passed passed a law making it a Class C felony to take a monk seal. And the word take meaning like harm or kill a monk seal. That's kind of like their definition of it. And a person violating that state law could face a fine up to $50,000 and up to 5 years in prison if convicted. But, you know, despite these laws that are in place, monk seals have continued to be harassed and even killed from visitors and residents. But most of these harassment cases or killings, they're not caught on camera. And monk seal advocates say it's been a constant battle to protect marine wildlife from harm. I spoke to Melina Clark. She's a monk seal advocate based on Oahu. She says there needs to be more education for visitors and more accountability for people who break the laws, both federal and state officials.
The Department of Land and Natural Resources continues to hand over these types of incidents to NOAA Fisheries. They both have a responsibility under the laws to cite people, give citations, to arrest, and to get them into the courtroom. It's just not happening, even with video that they require, video and photographs and witness statements. It still goes unnoticed, and they let people walk. And there's no
accountability.
Yeah, there's no accountability. There's nothing, there's no threat. You come to Hawaii or you live here, everybody knows nothing's going to be done about it.
That other voice that you heard is another monk seal advocate, Shome Bossett. Both of those two I interviewed in studio just last week. And, you know, they've actually been a part of like these volunteer groups trying to educate visitors by themselves on what not to do when you see a monk seal or how to protect them. And even like fence off when a monk seal is giving birth. They say they have to do it on their own. But when I talked to a DLNR spokesperson, they said in these cases, federal law preempts state law. Here's William Isla on why the federal side takes over these cases.
We always deferred to the federal side first because their resources were much better than ours in terms of putting forth a case. There weren't that many because at the time I was the chair, there weren't a lot of witnesses that were willing to come forward, and there weren't a lot of people with telephones with cameras on them near the beaches. So I think in my tenure at DLNR, I think we only had one case that was prosecuted and the person sort of bled out and got a fine.
So when I talked to the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, they gave me data. So they confirmed 17 intentional killings of monk seals since 2009, and only one person has been prosecuted. And among those 17 intentional killings, that involved a pregnant female monk seal. Under state law, making that a Class C felony for harming or killing monk seals. I've only gotten in the last 10 years data, 6 people have been charged within the last year under that law. So monk seal advocates, they want more education for both visitors and residents. And for example, some monk seal advocates have told me they want more PSAs on flights because some flights don't have the screens. Mm-hmm. So they don't know like the education purposes. But when I talked to Representative Adrian Tam of the Hawaii State Legislature, he's actually planning to introduce a couple measures that would require incoming flights to Hawaii to do a public service announcement to inform visitors on Hawaii's wildlife.
Another law that I'm thinking about is going alongside the pre-recorded message, but to also include a statement in our current agriculture declaration form that would educate our visitors about our current laws, as well as include a website to gohawaii.com about what are the penalties of the laws, what endangered species are out there that are protected. Our current desecration laws for our Native Hawaiian cultural sites and burial grounds and places of worship, and to have visitors affirm that they are aware of these protections when they turn in those ag forms.
Yeah, a lot of efforts to try and raise the awareness of everybody. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Age and income don't matter when it comes to supporting HPR. Whether you're 23 or 83, you can make a meaningful gift to HPR through your will, trust, or other estate plan. You can even name the station as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy or retirement plan. And when you do, let us know so we can recognize you in our legacy society. Learn more and get started at hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, committed to supporting Hawaii food producers and makers. Learn more about its locally sourced Mountain Apple brand products at ktasuperstores.com.
Two years ago, a Hawaii teen took on the Ka'iwi Channel and became the youngest swimmer to make the 26-mile crossing. Jonathan Easer's record held for 39 years. He wrote a book about the experience, about how it changes life. There have been several teens who have swum the channel since the 70s. The youngest, whose record still stands, was 15. Today, we spend time with Easer, who these days swims laps in a pool where he lives in Texas. His book is called Edge of Land, a Swimming of Age story. Here's Easer.
The physical, especially when you're a teenager, is actually the easy part. You know, you're in the best shape of your life when you're 17, 16, 17, or 18. It is the mental toughness. There is nothing that you have done previously that prepares you for it. And it is getting your head in the right place to do something in a place that you have never done it before.
And what got this even on your radar to try and swim miles across a channel like this?
Well, when I was a junior at Kalani, the summer after I was a junior, I was lucky enough to get a job with the city and county as a lifeguard. And my brother, my older brother, had been working at Sandy Beach, and they needed a guard. So they were asking around. My brother suggested me. I went down to the lifeguard headquarters, which at the time was at the Natatorium, and a gentleman by the name of Aloha Ka'eo hired me on the spot. So I started working at Sandy Beach and became friends with most of the lifeguards who were working there. Towards the end of the summer, one of them, who was also a good friend of my brother's, we were sitting in a parking lot after a really rough day, and we were eating lunch about 6 o'clock at night. And he looked across and he said, "If you see it, you can swim it." And everybody went, "Yeah, if you see it, you can swim it." And that kind of put the idea in my head more as a dare than it, as opposed to, I guess, it's something I wanted to do. And it took off from there. It took me a year to prepare to do it physically. I had to change the way I trained from high school swimming, short distances, to being able to go 2, 3, 4 hours without stopping.
Yeah, I mean, when you compete in swimming, right, you're in a pool.
With turns and a bottom and a line to tell you where you are in the pool. Yeah, it was exactly right.
But I find, though, it's so liberating when you're in the ocean. You know, there is no line, but, you know, well, the sky's the limit, you know, however you want to put that. But yeah, there's no, it's no limitations.
It goes back to the question you just asked. The limitation is in your mind. You will go as far as you think you can go if you believe in your head that you can do it. In a pool, you go 50 meters or 25 meters or 25 yards and you turn and you come back and you continue to do that. And the good thing about swimming the Molokai Channel is that it's one lap.
That's true. One very long lap. But there are all kinds of creatures that can make it more difficult, whether they're jellyfish, right? Noceums and sharks.
Yes, and it's something that you think about. I was lucky in this regard. I had 10 or 11 other people who were with me as the crew, and it was their job to look out for fish, sharks, jellyfish. In fact, one of them, Johnny Mounts, stayed, I don't know, about 15, 20 yards ahead of me the entire swim, clearing a path when there were jellyfish and Portuguese men of war. So I kind of followed him for a little bit when we had or we knew that jellyfish were there. The one thing about sharks is they come up from the bottoms or from below. So I don't know how good the lookouts were for that.
Well, talk about close calls that you might have had where, I don't know, maybe you were, you know, at a point where you thought, oh, I should just hang this up.
You mean during the swim?
Yeah.
No, that thought never occurred to me in regards to any kind of jellyfish or sharks or anything like that. The only time I say that might have occurred is after about 9 hours. I was off of Sandy Beach. I could pick up my head and I could see the beach. I could see the cars. I could see people walking. And I put my head down thinking I only had 15 minutes. And 2 hours later, I was a mile and a half offshore, almost 2 miles offshore, because the tides had changed and pushed me out. It's at that point where you start thinking, can I do this?
Yeah, because you're tortured. Like, I see land. I see the shore.
Yeah, you. I see the shore. I think the shore. I feel the shore, but I'm not on shore.
Well, you know, after you completed this, I mean, you were, the youngest swimmer, and you swam it pretty darn fast, and your records held for a very long time. And over the years, you know, we've seen younger swimmers also complete it. And that's just a marvelous thing that always just blows me away when, you know, like doing the rough water and there are these 12 and 14-year-olds that swim way faster than me. It's like, wow.
Yes, it is. It is wonderful to see that younger kids are doing it. When I was there, I had to wait till I was 18 because my mother wouldn't let me do it until I was an adult, right? But times have changed and challenges are becoming a little more commonplace for younger swimmers.
Well, talk about how holding that record and completing that very hard thing, swimming across the channel so many miles, how that changed your life. Or set your life on a path?
Well, I was lucky in this regard. I started swimming with Coach Soichi Sakamoto back in like 1962. The many things that Coach taught us was discipline, technique, and mind over matter. And that was kind of taught to me and drilled into me since I was six. The swim or training for the swim, I used those same things that Coach Sakamoto had taught me. And you carry those on into your life in a sense that you figure out what it is you want to do. You stick to it and you are disciplined about the result. You know what you have to do in order to get a result, and you have to basically have a certain kind of stick-to-itness that is instilled in you at a very early age. if that makes sense.
Yeah, you persevere.
It is partly perseverance. It is also, I think, a large part whether or not it is in your makeup to do that perseverance.
Well, you know, you completed this swim. And I know then what was the, is it that next year that you did the rough water and you also won that one?
Actually, I did the rough water 2 years before the Molokai swim. The rough water was the first time I had ever participated in anything that was not in a pool.
Ah, I see. So that kind of gave you that boost of confidence.
Well, it also kind of it got me interested in swimming outside of a pool and that there were events that you could do it. I believe the year that I swam it and won, it was the second time that they had the Waikiki Rough Water. It was 1972. And I believe the rough water started either in 1970 or 1971. So it was still a rather small event, but it, like I said, it was the first time I had swum outside of a pool, and it was really, really cool, I thought.
What else would you like to share with the listeners about the experience of swimming in the open ocean like that? You know, man versus nature, I guess.
It's really not man versus nature. I've always had the attitude that man goes into nature, and nature lets man survive. And when I swam the channel, I had a deep and abiding love for the ocean and a respect for the ocean. As I said, I had lifeguarded at Sandy Beach, and the one thing that you learn very quickly is that you never turn your back on the water. And when you're in the middle of it, you have this feeling that you are very insignificant in the middle of something so vast and so deep. And I truly believe that, especially with the younger kids who are swimming it now, I believe that they have the same respect for the water, or at least I hope that they have the same respect for the water and for just the whole vastness of nature that is part of Hawaii.
We've been hearing from Jonathan Easer, who held the record for the youngest swimmer to cross the Ka'iwi Channel. His book, The Edge of Land, is out now. Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, could a blood test help assess the risk for heart attacks and stroke? We hear about local efforts to try and do just that. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Do you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.